Then. No paper trail. That was Tony Shane Dink's decree, and it was followed. People still knew how matters pertaining to the Buick were to be handled, though, what the proper channels were. It wasn't tough. One either reported to Kurt, the Sarge, or to Sandy Dearborn. They were the Buick guys. Sandy supposed he'd become part of that triumvirate simply by virtue of having been present at the infamous autopsy. Certainly it wasn't because he had any special curiosity about the thing. Tony's no-paper edict notwithstanding, Sandy was quite sure that Kurt kept his own records, notes, and speculations about the Buick. If so, he was discreet about it. Meanwhile, the temperature drops and the energy discharges, the light quakes, seemed to be slowing down. The life was draining out of the thing. Or so they all hoped. Sandy kept no notes and could never have provided a reliable sequence of events. The videotapes made over the years would have helped do that if it ever needed doing, but there would still be gaps and questions. Not every light quake was taped, and so what if they had been? They were all pretty much the same. There were probably a dozen between 1979 and 1983. Most were small. A couple were as big as the first one, and one was even bigger. That big one, the all-time champ, came in 1983. Those who were there sometimes still called 83 the year of the fish, as if they were Chinese. Curtis made a number of experiments between 79 and 83, leaving various plants and animals in and around the Buick when the temperature dropped. But all the results were essentially reruns of what happened with Jimmy and Rosalind. Which is to say, sometimes things disappeared, and sometimes they didn't. There was no way of predicting in advance. It all seemed as random as a coin toss. During one temperature drop, Kurt left a guinea pig by the roadmaster's left front tire, put it in a plastic bucket. 24 hours after the purple fireworks were over, and the temperature in the shed had gone back to normal, the guinea pig was still in his bucket, hopping and reasonably happy. Before another light show, Kurt put a cage with two frogs in it directly under the Buick. There were still two frogs in the cage after the light show ended. A day later, however, there was only one frog in the cage. A day after that, the cage was empty. Then there was the famous trunk experiment of 1982. That one was Tony's idea. He and Kurt put six cockroaches in a clear plastic box, then put the box in the Buick's trunk. This was directly after one of the fireworks shows had ended, and it was still cold enough in the Buick so that they could see vapor coming out of their mouths when they bent into the trunk. 3 days went by, with one of them checking the trunk every day, always with a rope tied around the waist of the one doing the checking, and everyone wondering what good a damn rope would do against something that had been able to snatch Jimmy out of his gerbil condo without opening either of the hatches, or the frogs out of their latch cage, for that matter. The roaches were fine the first day, and the second, and the third. Kurt and Tony went out on the fourth day to retrieve them, another failed experiment, back to the old drawing board. Only the roaches were gone, or so it seemed when they first opened the trunk. "No, wait," Kurt yelled. "There they are, I see them, running around like mad bastards." "How many?" Tony called back. He was standing outside the door on the side of the shed, holding the end of the rope. "Are they all there? How'd they get out of the damn box, Curtis?" Curtis counted only four instead of six, but that didn't mean much. Cockroaches don't need a bewitched automobile to help them disappear. They are quite good at that on their own, as anybody who's ever chased one with a slipper knows. As for how they'd gotten out of the plastic box, that much was obvious. It was still latched shut, but now there was a small, round hole in one side of it. The hole was 3/4 of an inch across. To Kurt and the Sarge, it looked like a large-caliber bullet hole. There were no cracks radiating out from it, which might also indicate that something had punched through at an extremely high velocity. Or perhaps burned through. No answers. Only mirages. Same as it ever was. And then the fish came in June of 1983. It had been at least 2.5 years since Troop D had kept a day-in-and-out watch on the Buick, because by late 1979 or early 1980, they had decided that, with reasonable precautions, there wasn't much to worry about. A loaded gun is dangerous, no argument, but you don't have to post an around-the-clock guard on one to make sure it won't shoot by itself. If you put it up on a high shelf and keep the kiddies away, that's usually enough to do the trick. Tony bought a vehicle tarp so anyone who came out back and happened to look in the shed wouldn't see the car and ask questions. In 81, a new fellow from the motor pool, a Buick fancier, had once offered to buy it. The video camera stayed out in the hutch, mounted on its tripod, and with a plastic bag pulled over it to keep it free of moisture. And the chair was still there, plus a good high stack of magazines beneath it. But Archie began to use the place more and more as a gardening shed. Bags of peat and fertilizer, pallets of sod, and flower planters first began to crowd the Buick watching stuff and then to crowd it out. The only time the hutch reverted to its original purpose was just before, during, and after one of the light quakes. June, in the year of the fish, was one of the most beautiful early summer months in Sandy's memory. The grass, lush, the birds all in tune, the air filled with a kind of delicate heat, like a teenage couple's first real kiss. Tony Shaindinks was on vacation visiting his daughter on the West Coast. She was the one whose baby had caused all that trouble. The sergeant and his wife were trying to mend a few fences before they got broken down entirely. Probably not a bad plan. Sandy Dearborn and Huddy Royer were in charge while he was gone, but Curtis Wilcox, no longer a rookie, was boss of the Buick, no doubt about that. And one day in that marvelous June, Buck Flanders came to see him in that capacity. "Temps down in Shed B," he said. Curtis raised his eyebrows. "Not exactly the first time, is it?" "No," Buck admitted, "but I've never seen it go down so fast. 10 degrees since this morning." That got Kurt out to the shed in a hurry, with the old, excited light in his eyes. When he put his face to one of the windows in the roll-up front door, the first thing he noticed was the tarp Tony had bought. It was crumpled along the driver's side of the Buick like a scuffed-up rug. Wasn't the first time for that, either. It was as if the Buick sometimes trembled or shrugged, and slid the nylon cover off like a lady shrugging off an evening wrap by lifting her shoulders. The needle on the round thermometer stood at 61. "It's 74 out here," Buck said. He was standing at Kurt's elbow. "I checked the thermometer over by the bird feeder before coming in to see you." "So it's actually gone down 13 degrees, not 10.
"Well, it was 64 in there when I came to get you. That's how fast it's going down. Like, a cold front setting in or something. Want me to get Huddy?"
"Let's not bother him. Make up a watch roster. Get Matt Babicki to help you. Mark it, a car wash detail. Let's get two guys watching the Buick the rest of the day and tonight as well, unless Huddy says no or the temp bounces back up."
"Okay," Buck said. "You want to be on the first stand?"
Kurt did, and quite badly. He sensed something was going to happen, but he shook his head.
"Can't. I have court, and there's that truck trap over in Cambria."
Tony would have screamed and clutched his head if he had heard Kurt call the weigh-in on Highway 9 a truck trap, but essentially, that was what it was. Because someone was moving heroin and cocaine from New Jersey over that way, and the thinking was that it was moving in some of the independent truckers' loads.
"Truth is, I'm busier than a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. Damn."
He struck his thigh with his fist, then cupped his hands to the sides of his face and peered in through the glass again. There was nothing to see but the roadmaster,
sitting in two bars of sunlight that crisscrossed on the long, dark blue hood, like the contending beams of spotlights.
"Get Randy Santerre. And didn't I see Chris Soder mooning around?"
"Yeah. He's technically off duty, but his wife's two sisters are still visiting from over Ohio when he came here to watch TV." Buck lowered his voice. "Don't want to tell you your business, Kurt, but I think both those guys are jagoffs."
"They'll do for this.
They'll have to. Tell them I want regular reports, too, standard code D, and I'll call in by landline before I leave court."
Kurt took a final, almost anguished look at the Buick, then started back to the barracks, where he would shave and get ready for the witness stand. In the afternoon, he'd be poking in the backs of trucks along with some boys from Troop G, looking for coke and hoping nobody decided to unlimber an automatic weapon. He would have found someone to swap with if there had been time, but there wasn't.
Soder and Santerre got Buick watching duty instead, and they didn't mind. Jagoffs never do. They stood beside the hutch, smoking, shooting the shit, taking the occasional look in at the Buick. Santerre, too young to know what to expect, and he never lasted long in the PSP anyway. Telling jokes and enjoying the day. It was a June day so simple and so simply beautiful that even a jagoff couldn't help but enjoy it. At some point, Buck Flanders spelled Randy Santerre. A little later on, Orville Garrett spelled Chris Soder. Huddy came out for the occasional peek. At 3 o'clock, when Sandy came in to drop his ass in the SC's chair, Curtis Wilcox finally got back and spelled Buck out by Shed B. Far from rebounding, the shed's temperature had rolled off another 10 degrees by then, and off-duty troopers began to clog the lot out back with their personal vehicles. Word had spread. Code D. Around 4 p.m., Matt Babicki stuck his head into the SC's office and told Sandy he was losing the radio.
"Bad static, boss. Worst ever."
Shit. Sandy closed his eyes, rubbed his knuckles against them, and wished for Tony. This was his first time as acting sergeant commanding, and while the temporary bump in his paycheck at the end of the month would no doubt be satisfying, this aggravation was not. "Trouble with that goddamn car. Just what I wanted."
"Don't take it to heart," Matt said. "It'll shoot off a few sparks and then everything'll go back to normal, including the radio. Isn't that the way it usually goes?"
Yes, that was the way it usually went. Sandy was not in truth especially worried about the Buick, but what if someone out on patrol found trouble while communications were foobar? Someone who had to call in a 33. "Help me quick." Or a 47. "Send an ambulance." Or worst of all, a 1099. "Officer down." Sandy had well over a dozen guys out there, and at that moment it felt as if every one of them was riding him piggyback.
"Listen to me, Matt. Get in my ride. It's Unit 17, and take it down to the bottom of the hill. You should be clear of interference there. Call every one of ours currently running the roads and tell them base dispatch is temporarily 17, code D."
"Aw, Sandy, Jesus, isn't that a little..."
"I don't have time to listen to your imitation of Siskel and Ebert at the movies just now," Sandy said. He had never felt more impatient with Police Communications Officer Babicki's whiny brand of foot-dragging bullshit than he did then.
"Just do it."
"But I won't be here to see..."
"No, probably you won't," Sandy's voice rising a little now. "That's one you'll absolutely have to put on your TS list before you send it to the chaplain."
Matt started to say something else, took a closer look at Sandy's face, and wisely decided to keep his mouth shut. 2 minutes later, Sandy saw him headed down the hill, behind the wheel of Unit 17.
"Good," Sandy muttered. "Stay there a while, you little back-talking pissant."
Sandy went out to Shed B, where there was quite a little crowd. Most of them were troopers, but some were motor pool guys in the grease-stained green dickies that were their unofficial uniform. After 4 years of living with the Buick, none of them were afraid, exactly, but they were a rather nervy group that day, just the same. When you saw 20 degrees roll off the thermometer on a warm summer day,
in a room where the air conditioning consisted of an occasionally open door, it was hard not to believe that something large was in the works. Kurt had been back long enough to set up a number of experiments, all he had time to arrange, Sandy guessed. On the Buick's front seat, he'd placed a Nike sneaker box with some crickets in it. The frog cage was on the back seat. There was only one frog in it this time, but it was a whopper, one of those marsh bullfrogs with the bulgy yellow-black eyes. He had also taken the window box of flowers, which had been outside Matt Babicki's office window, and stuck them in the Buick's trunk. Last but not least, he took Mr. Dillon for a promenade out there, toured him all around the car on his leash, the full 360, just to see what would happen. Orvie Garrett didn't like that much, but Kurt talked him into it. In most respects, Kurt was still a little rough around the edges and a little wet behind the ears, but when it came to the Buick, he could be as smooth as a riverboat gambler. Nothing happened during Dee's walk, not that time, but it was clear the troop mascot would rather have been just about anywhere else. He hung at the end of his leash so hard it choked him a little, and he walked with his head down and his tail lowered, giving the occasional dry cough. He looked at the Buick, but he looked at everything else out there as well, as if whatever it was he didn't like had spread out from the bogus car until it contaminated the whole shed. When Kurt brought him outside again and handed the leash back to Orville, he said, "There's something going on. He feels it, and so do I. But it's not like before." He saw Sandy and repeated it. "Not like before." "No," Sandy said, then nodded at Mr. D. "At least he's not howling." "Not yet," Orville said. "Come on, D, let's go back in the barracks. You did good. I'll give you a bones." What Orvie gave Kurt was a final reproachful look. Mr. Dillon trotted neatly at Trooper Garrett's right knee, no longer needing the leash to keep him at heel. At 4:20 or so, the TV upstairs in the common room suddenly went goofy. By 4:40, the temperature in Shed B had dropped to 49 degrees. At 4:50, Curtis Wilcox shouted, "It's starting! I hear it!" Sandy had been inside to check on dispatch, and what a snafu it was by then. Nothing but one big balls-to-the-wall roar of static. And when Kurt yelled, he was returning across the parking lot, where there were now so many personals, you would have thought it was the police benefit rummage sale or the muscular dystrophy kids' carnival they put on each July. Sandy broke into a run, cutting through the knot of spectators craning to look in through the side door, which was still, unbelievably, standing wide open. And Kurt was there, standing in it. Waves of cold were rolling out, but he seemed not to feel them. His eyes were huge. And when he turned to Sandy, he was like a man dreaming. "Do you see it? Sandy, do you see it?" Of course he did. A waxing violet glow that was spilling out of the car's windows and seeping up through the crack which outlined the trunk lid and went spilling down the Buick sides like some thin radioactive fluid. Inside the car, Sandy could clearly see the shapes of the seats and the oversized steering wheel. They were outlines. Silhouettes. The rest of the cabin was swallowed in a cold, purple glare, brighter than any furnace. The hum was loud and getting louder. It made Sandy's skull ache, made his ears almost wish they were deaf. Not that being deaf would do any good, because you seemed to hear that sound not just with your ears, but with your whole body. Sandy yanked Kurt out onto the pavement, then grabbed the knob, meaning to shut the door. Kurt took hold of his wrist. "No, Sandy, no. I want to see it. I want..." Sandy peeled his hand off, not gently. "Are you crazy? There's a procedure we follow on this, a goddamn procedure. No one should know that better than you. You help think it up, for God's sake." When Sandy slammed the door shut, cutting off any direct view of the Buick, Kurt's eyelids fluttered, and he twitched like a man waking out of a deep sleep. "Okay," he said. "Okay, boss. I'm sorry. It's all right." Not really believing it was, because the damn fool would have stood right there in the doorway. No question about it in Sandy's mind. Would have stood there and been fried, if frying was on that thing's agenda.
I need to get my goggles, Kurt said. They're in the trunk of my car. I have extras and they're extra dark, a whole box of them. Do you want a pair?
Sandy still got the feeling that Kurt wasn't fully awake, that he was only pretending, like you did when the telephone rang in the middle of the night.
Sure, why not? But we're going to be cautious, right? Because this is looking like a bad one.
Looking like a great one,
he said, and the exuberance in his voice, although slightly scary, made Sandy feel a little better. At least Kurt didn't sound as if he was sleepwalking any longer.
But yes, Mother, we'll follow procedure and be as cautious as hell.
He ran for his car, not the cruiser, but his personal, the restored Bel Air, and opened the trunk. He was still rummaging in the boxes of stuff he kept back there when the Buick exploded. It did not literally explode, but there seemed to be no other word for what it did do. Those who were there that day never forgot it, but they talked about it remarkably little, even among themselves, because there seemed no way to express the terrifying magnificence of it, the power of it. The best they could say was that it darkened the June sun and seemed to turn the shed transparent into a ghost of itself. It was impossible to comprehend how mere glass could stand between that light and the outside world. The throbbing brilliance poured through the boards of the shed like water through cheesecloth. The shapes of the nails stood out like the dots in a newspaper photograph, or purple beads of blood on top of a fresh tattoo. Sandy heard Carl Brundage shout, "She's gonna blow this time! She most surely will!" From behind him in the barracks, he could hear Mr. Dillon howling in terror.
"But he still wanted to get out and get at it," Orville told Sandy later. "I had him in the upstairs lounge as far from that goddamn shed as I could get him, but it didn't make any difference. He knew it was there, heard it, I imagine, heard it humming. Then he saw the window. Holy Christ! If I hadn't been quick, hadn't grabbed him right off, I think he would have jumped right through it, second story or not. He pissed all over me. I never realized it till half an hour later. That's how scared I was."
Orville shook his head, his face heavy and thoughtful.
"Never seen a dog like that. Never. His fur was all bushed out. He was foaming at the mouth, and his eyeballs looked like they were popping right out of his head. Christ!"
Kurt, meanwhile, came running back with a dozen pairs of protective goggles. The troopers put them on, but there was still no way of looking in at the Buick. It was impossible to even approach the windows. And again, there was that weird silence, when they all felt they should have been standing at the center of a cacophony, hearing thunder and landslides and erupting volcanoes. With the shed's doors shut, they, unlike Mr. D, couldn't even hear the humming noise. There was the shuffle of feet and someone clearing his throat and Mr. Dillon howling in the barracks and Orvy Garrett telling him to calm down, and the sound of Matt Babicki's static drowned radio from dispatch, where the window, now denuded of its flower box thanks to Kurt, had been left open. Nothing else. Kurt walked to the roll-up door, head bent and hands raised. Twice he tried to lift his face and look inside Shed B, but he couldn't. It was too bright. Sandy grabbed his shoulder.
"Quit trying to look. You can't do it. Not yet, anyway. It'll knock the eyes right out of your head."
"What is it, Sandy?" he whispered. "What in God's name is it?"
Sandy could only shake his head. For the next half hour, the Buick put on the light show to end all light shows, turning Shed B into a kind of fireball, shooting parallel lines of brilliance through all the windows, flashing and flashing, a gaudy neon furnace without heat or sound. If anyone from John Q. Public's family had turned up during that time, God knew what they might have thought, or who they would have told, or how much those they told might have believed. But no outsiders did turn up, and by 5:30, the D-troopers had started to see individual flashes of light again, as if the power source driving the phenomenon had begun to wobble. It made Sandy think of the way a motorcycle will lurch and spurt when the gas tank is almost dry. Kurt edged up to the windows again, and although he had to duck down each time one of those bolts of light shot out, he could take little peeks in between. Sandy joined him, ducking away from the brighter pulses. "We probably look like we're practicing some weird drill routine," he thought, squinting, eyes dazzled in spite of the triple layer of polarized glass in the goggles. The Buick was still perfectly intact and apparently unchanged. The tarp lay in its same draped dune, unsinged by any fire. Arky's tools hung undisturbed on their pegs, and the stacks of old County American newspapers were still in the far corner, bundled and tied with twine. A single kitchen match would have been enough to turn those dry piles of old news into pillars of flame, but all that brilliant purple light hadn't charred so much as a single corner of a single Bradley's circular. "Sandy, can you see any of the specimens?" Sandy shook his head, stood back, and took off the goggles Kurt had loaned him. He passed them on to Andy Colucci, who was wild for a look into the shed. Sandy himself headed back to the barracks. Shed B was not going to blow up after all, it seemed. And he was the acting SC, with a job to do. On the back step, he paused and looked back. Even wearing goggles, Andy Colucci and the others were reluctant to approach the row of windows. There was only one exception, and that was Curtis Wilcox. He stood right there, big as Billy be damned, Sandy's mother might have said, as close as he could get, and leaning forward to get even closer, goggles actually pressed to the glass, only turning his head aside slightly each time the thing flashed out an especially bright bolt, which it was still doing every 20 seconds or so. Sandy thought, he's apt to put his eyes out, or at least go snowblind from it. Except he wouldn't. He seemed to have almost timed the flashes to have gotten in rhythm with them. From where Sandy was, it looked as if Curtis was actually turning his face aside a second or two before each flash came. And when it did come, he would for a moment become his own exclamatory shadow, an exotic frozen dancer caught against a great sheet of purple light. Looking at him that way was scary. To Sandy, it was like watching something that was there and not there at the same time. Real, but not real. Both solid and mirage. Sandy would later think that when it came to the Buick 8, Kurt was oddly like Mr. Dillon. He wasn't howling like the dog was upstairs in the common room, but he seemed in touch with the thing just the same, in sync with it, dancing with it. Then and later, that was how it would come back to Sandy. Dancing with it. At 6:10 that evening, Sandy radioed down the hill to Matt and asked what was up. Matt said nothing. "Nothing, Grandma," was what Sandy heard in his tone, and Sandy told him to come on back to base. When he did, Sandy said he was free to step across the parking lot and have a look at old 54 if he still wanted one. Matt was gone like a shot. When he came back a few minutes later, he looked disappointed. "I've seen it do that before," he said, leaving Sandy to reflect on how dense and thankless human beings were for the most part, how quickly their senses dulled, rendering the marvelous mundane. "Well, the guy said it really blew its stack an hour ago, but none of them could describe it." This was said with a contempt Sandy didn't find surprising. In the world of the police communications officer, everything is describable. The world's cartography must and can be laid out in 10 codes. "Well, don't look at me," Sandy said. "I can tell you one thing, though. It was bright." "Oh, bright." Matt gave him a look that said, not just a grandma, but a loser grandma. Then he went back inside. By 7 o'clock, Troop D's TV reception, always an important consideration when you were off the road, had returned to normal. Dispatch communications were back to normal. Mr. Dillon had eaten his usual big bowl of gravy train and then hung out in the kitchen, trolling for scraps, so he was back to normal. And when Kurt poked his head into the SC's office at 7:45 to tell Sandy he wanted to go into the shed and check on his specimens, Sandy could think of no way to stop him. Sandy was in charge of Troop D that evening, no argument there, but when it came to the Buick, Kurt had as much authority as he did. Maybe even a little more. Also, Kurt was already wearing the damn yellow rope around his waist. The rest was looped over his forearm in a coil.
"Not a good idea," Sandy told him. That was about as close to no as he could get.
"Bosh!" It was Curtis's favorite word in 1983. Sandy hated it. He thought it was a snotty word. He looked over Kurt's shoulder and saw they were alone.
"Curtis," he said, "you've got a wife at home, and the last time we talked about her, you said she might be pregnant. Has that changed?"
"No, but she hasn't been to the..."
"So you've got a wife for sure, and a maybe baby. And if she's not preg this time, she probably will be next time. That's nice. It's just the way it should be. What I don't understand is why you'd put all that on the line for that goddamn Buick.
Come on, Sandy. I put it on the line every time I get into a cruiser and go out on the road. Every time I step out and approach, it's true of everyone who works the job."
"This is different, and we both know it, so you can quit the high school debate crap. Don't you remember what happened to Ennis?"
"I remember," he said, and Sandy supposed he did.
But Ennis Rafferty had been gone almost 4 years by then. He was, in a way, as out of date as the stacks of county Americans in Shed B. And as for more recent developments, well, the Frogs had just been Frogs. Jimmy might have been named after a president, but he was really just a gerbil. And Curtis was wearing the rope. The rope was supposed to make everything all right. Sure, Sandy thought. And no toddler wearing a pair of water wings ever drowned in a swimming pool. If he said that to Kurt, would Curtis laugh? No. Because Sandy was sitting in the big chair that night, the acting SC, the visible symbol of the PSP. But Sandy thought he would see laughter in Kurt's eyes just the same. Curtis had forgotten the rope had never been tested. That if the force hiding inside the Buick decided it wanted him, there might be a single last flash of purple light, and then nothing but a length of yellow line lying on the cement floor with an empty loop at the end of it. So long, partner. Happy trails to you. One more curious cat off hunting satisfaction in the big nowhere. But Sandy couldn't order him to stand down as he'd ordered Matt Babicki to drive down the hill. All he could do was get into an argument with him, and it was no good arguing with a man who had that bright and twirly let's-play-bingo look in his eyes. You could cause plenty of hard feelings, but you could never convince the other guy that you had the right side of the argument.
"You want me to hold the other end of the rope?" Sandy asked him. "You came in here wanting something, and it surely wasn't my opinion."
"Would you?" he grinned. "I'd like that." Sandy went out with him, and he held the rope, with most of the coils snubbed around his elbow, and Dickie Duck Elliott standing behind him, ready to grab his belt loops if something happened and Sandy started to slide. The acting SC, standing in the side doorway of Shed B, not braced, but ready to brace if something funny happened, biting his lower lip and breathing just a little too fast. His pulse felt like maybe 120 beats a minute. He could still feel the chill in the shed, even though the thermometer was by then easing its way back up. In Shed B, early summer had been revoked, and what one met at the door was the dank cold of a hunting camp when you arrive in November, the stove in the middle of the room, as dead as an unchurched god. Time slowed to a crawl. Sandy opened his mouth to ask Kurt if he was going to stay in there forever, then glanced down at his watch and saw only 40 seconds had passed. He did tell Kurt not to go around to the far side of the Buick. Too much chance of snagging the rope. "And Curtis, when you open the trunk, stand clear."
Roger that.
He sounded almost amused, indulgent, like a kid promising Mother and Dad that no, he won't speed. He won't take a drink at the party. He will watch out for the other guy. Oh, gosh, yes, of course, you bet. Anything to keep them happy long enough to get the Christ out of the house, and then, yee-haw.
He opened the driver's door of the Buick and leaned in past the steering wheel. Sandy braced again for the pull he more than half expected, the yank. He must have communicated the feeling backward, because he felt Dickie grab his belt loops. Kurt reached, and then stood up holding the shoebox with the crickets inside. He peered through the holes.
"Looks like they're all still there," he said, sounding a little disappointed.
"You'd think they'd be roasted," Dickie Duck said. "All that fire?"
There had been no fire, just light. There wasn't a single scorch mark on the shed's walls. They could see the thermometer's needle standing in the 50s, and electing not to believe that number wasn't much of an option, not with the shed's dank chill pushing into their faces. Still, Sandy knew how Dickie Duck Elliott felt. When your head was still pounding from the dazzle, and the last of the afterimages still seemed to be dancing in front of your eyes, it was hard to believe that a bunch of crickets sitting on ground zero could come through unscathed. Yet they had. Every single one of them, as it turned out. So did the bullfrog, except its yellow-black eyes had gone cloudy and dull. It was present and accounted for, but when it hopped right into the wall of its cage. It had gone blind. Kurt opened the trunk and moved back from it all in the same gesture, a move almost like ballet, and one most policemen know. Sandy braced in the doorway again, hands fisted on the slack rope, ready for it to go taut. Dickie Duck once more snagged a tight hold on his belt loops. And again, there was nothing. Kurt leaned into the trunk. "Cold in here," he called. His voice sounded hollow, oddly distant. "And I'm getting that smell, the cabbage smell, also peppermint, and wait." Sandy waited. When nothing came, he called Kurt's name. "I think it's salt," Kurt said. "Like the ocean, almost. This is the center of it, the vortex, right here in the trunk. I'm sure of it."
"I don't care if it's the lost Dutchman mine," Sandy told him. "I want you out of there. Now. Just a second more."
He leaned deep into the trunk. Sandy almost expected him to jerk forward as if something was pulling him, Kurt Wilcox's idea of a knee slapper. Perhaps he thought of it, but in the end, he knew better. He simply got Matt Babicki's window box and pulled it out. He turned and held it up so Sandy and Dickie could see. The flowers looked fine and blooming. They were dead a couple of days later, but there was nothing very supernatural about that. They had been frozen in the trunk of the car, as surely as they would have been if Curtis had put them in the freezer for a while.
"Are you done yet?" Sandy was even starting to sound like old Gammer Dearborn to himself, but he couldn't help it.
"Yeah, guess so."
Curtis sounding disappointed. Sandy jumped when he slammed the Buick's trunk lid back down, and Dickie's fingers tightened on the back of his pants. Sandy had an idea old Dickie Duck had come pretty close to yanking him right out of the doorway and onto his ass in the parking lot. Kurt, meantime, walked slowly toward them with the frog cage, the sneaker box, and the window box stacked up in his arms. Sandy kept coiling up the rope as he came so Kurt wouldn't trip over it. When they were all outside again, Dickie took the cage and looked wonderingly at the blind bullfrog.
"That beats everything," he said.
Kurt slipped out of the loop around his waist, then knelt on the macadam and opened the shoebox. Four or five other troopers had gathered around by then.
The crickets hopped out almost as soon as Kurt took the lid off the box, but not before both Curtis and Sandy had a chance to take attendance. 8. The number of cylinders in yonder Buick's useless engine. 8. The same number of crickets that had gone in. Kurt looked disgusted and disappointed. "Nothing," he said. "In the end, that's what it always comes to. If there's a formula, some binomial theorem or a quadratic equation or something like that, I don't see it."
"Then maybe you better give it a pass," Sandy said.
Kurt lowered his head and watched the crickets go hopping across the parking lot, widening out from each other, going their separate ways. And no equation or theorem ever invented by any mathematician, whoever breathed, could predict where any single one of them might end up. They were chaos theory hopping. The goggles were still hung around Kurt's neck on their elastic strap. He fingered them for a few moments, then glanced at Sandy. His mouth was set. The disappointed look had gone out of his eyes. The other one, the half-crazed, let's play bingo until the money's all gone look, had come back to take its place.
"Don't think I'm ready to do that," he said. "There must be."
Sandy gave him a chance, and when Curtis didn't finish, he asked, "There must be what?" But Curtis only shook his head as if he could not say, or would not. 3 days went by. They waited for another bat thing or another cyclone of leaves, but there was nothing immediate in the wake of the light show. The Buick just sat there. Troop D's piece of Pennsylvania was quiet, especially on the second shift, which suited Sandy Dearborn right down to the ground. One more day, and he'd be off for two. Huddy's turn to run the show again. Then, when Sandy came back, Tony Shaindinks would be in the big chair where he belonged. The temperature in Shed B still hadn't equalized with the temperature of the outside world, but was getting there. It had risen into the low 60s, and Troop D had come to think of the 60s as safe territory. For the first 48 hours after the monster light quake, they'd kept someone out there around the clock. After 24 uneventful hours, some of the men had started grumbling about putting in the extra time, and Sandy couldn't much blame them. It was uncompensated time, of course. Had to be. How could they have sent overtime reports for Shed B watching to Scranton? What would they have put in the space marked reason for overtime activity? Kurt Wilcox wasn't crazy about dropping the full-time surveillance, but he understood the realities of the situation. In a brief conference, they decided on a week's worth of spot checks, most to be performed by troopers Dearborn and Wilcox. And if Tony didn't like that when he got back from sunny California, he could change it. So now comes 8 o'clock of a summer evening, right around the time of the solstice. The sun not down, but sitting red and bloated on the short hills, casting the last of its long and longing light. Sandy was in the office, beavering away at the weekend duty roster, that big chair fitting him pretty well just then. There were times when he could imagine himself sitting in it more or less permanently, and that summer evening was one of them. "I think I could do this job." That was what was going through his mind as George Morgan rolled up the driveway in Unit D-11. Sandy raised his hand to George and grinned when George ticked a little salute off the brim of his big hat in return. "Right back at you." George was on patrol that shift, but happened to be close by and so came in to gas up. By the 90s, Pennsylvania state troopers would no longer have that option. But in 1983, you could still pump your go juice at home and save the state a few pennies. He put the pump on slow automatic and strolled over to Shed B for a peek. There was a light on inside. They always left it on. And there it was, the Troop D bonus baby, old 54, sitting quiet with its chrome gleaming, looking as if it had never eaten a state trooper, blinded a frog, or produced a freak bat. George, still a few years from his personal finish line, 2 cans of beer and then the pistol in the mouth, jammed way up and back past the soft palate, not taking any chances. When a cop decides to do it, he or she almost always gets it right. Stood at the roll-up door, as they all did from time to time, adopting the stance they all seemed to adopt, kind of loose and spraddle-legged like a sidewalk superintendent at a city building site, hands on hips, pose A, or crossed on the chest, pose B, or cupped to the sides of the face if the day was especially bright, pose C. It's a stance that says the sidewalk superintendent in question is a man with more than a few of the answers. An expert gent, with plenty of time to discuss taxes, or politics, or the haircuts of the young. George had his look and was just about to turn away when all at once there was a thud from in there, toneless and heavy. This was followed by a pause. Long enough, he told Sandy later, for him to think he'd imagined the sound in the first place. And then there was a second thud. George saw the Buick's trunk lid move up and down in the middle, just once, quick. He started for the side door, meaning to go in and investigate. Then he recalled what he was dealing with, a car that sometimes ate people. He stopped, looked around for someone else, for backup, and saw no one. There's never a cop around when you need one. He considered going into the shed by himself anyway. Thought of Ennis, 4 years and still not home for lunch, and ran for the barracks instead. "Sandy, you better come." George, standing in the doorway, looking scared and out of breath. "I think maybe one of these idiots may have locked some other idiot in the trunk of that fucking nuisance in Shed B. You're like for a joke." Sandy stared at him, thunderstruck, unable or perhaps unwilling to believe that anyone, even that dope Santerre, could do such a thing. Except people could. He knew it. He knew something else as well. Incredible as it might seem, in many cases they meant no harm. George mistook the acting SC's surprise for disbelief. "I might be wrong, but honest to God, I'm not pulling your chain. Something's thumping the lid of the trunk. From the inside. Sounds like with his fist. I started to go in on my own, then changed my mind." "That was the right call," Sandy said. "Come on." They hurried out, stopping just long enough so Sandy could look in the kitchen and then bawl upstairs to the common room. No one. The barracks was never deserted, but it was deserted now. And why? Because there was never a cop around when you needed one. That was why. Herb Avery was running dispatch that night. At least that was one. And he joined them. "Want me to call someone in off the road? Sandy, I can if you want." "No." Sandy was looking around, trying to remember where he'd last seen the coil of rope. In the hutch, probably. Unless some yo-yo had taken it home to haul something upstairs with, which would be just about par for the course. "Come on, George." The two of them crossed the parking lot in the red sunset light, their trailing shadows all but infinite, going first to the roll-up door for a little look-see. The Buick sat there, as it had ever since old Johnny Parker dragged it in behind his tow truck. Johnny, now retired and getting through his nights with an oxygen tank beside his bed, but still smoking. It cast its own shadow on the concrete floor. Sandy started to turn away, meaning to check the hutch for the rope, and just as he did, there came another thump. It was strong and flat and unemphatic. The trunk lid shivered, dimpled up in the middle for a moment, then went back down. It looked to Sandy as if the roadmaster actually rocked a little bit on its springs. "There, you see?" George said. He started to add something else, and that was when the Buick's trunk came unlatched and the lid sprang up on its hinges and the fish fell out. Of course, it was a fish no more than the bat thing was a bat, but they both knew at once it was nothing made to live on land. It had not one gill on the side they could see, but four of them in a line, parallel slashes in its skin, which was the color of dark, tarnished silver. It had a ragged and membranous tail. It unfolded out of the trunk with a last, convulsive, dying shiver.
its bottom half curved and flexed, and Sandy could see how it might have made that thumping sound. Yes, that was clear enough, but how a thing of such size could ever have fit into the closed trunk of the Buick in the first place was beyond both of them. What hit the concrete floor of Shed B with a flat, wet slap was the size of a sofa. George and Sandy clutched each other like children and screamed. For a moment they were children, with every adult thought driven out of their heads. Somewhere inside the barracks, Mr. Dillon began to bark. It lay there on the floor, no more fish than a wolf is a house pet, although it may look quite a bit like a dog. And in any case, this fish was only a fish up to the purple slashes of its gills. Where a fish's head would have been, something that at least had the steadying sanity of eyes and a mouth, there was a knotted, naked mass of pink things, too thin and stiff to be tentacles, too thick to be hair. Each was tipped with a black node, and Sandy's first coherent thought was, a shrimp. The top half of it some kind of shrimp, and those black things are its eyes.
What's wrong? Someone bawled. What is it?
Sandy turned and saw Herb Avery on the back step. His eyes were wild, and he had his Ruger in his hand. Sandy opened his mouth, and at first nothing came out but a phlegmy little wheeze. Beside him, George hadn't even turned. He was still looking through the window, mouth hanging slack in an idiot's gape. Sandy took a deep breath and tried again. What was meant for a shout emerged as a faint, punched-in-the-belly wheeze, but at least it was something.
Everything's okay, Herb. 5 by 5. Go back inside. And why did you...
Go inside. There, that's a little better, Sandy thought. Go on now, Herb, and holster that piece. Herb looked down at the gun as if unaware until then that he had drawn it. He put it back in his holster, looked at Sandy as if to ask, was he sure? Sandy made little flapping gestures with his hands and thought, Granny Dearborn says go back inside, Dad, rat it. Herb went, yelling for Mr. D to shut up that foolish barking as he did. Sandy turned back to George, who had gone white. It was breathing, Sandy, or trying to. The gills were moving and the side was going up and down. Now it stopped. His eyes were huge, like the eyes of a child who has been in a car accident. I think it's dead. His lips were quivering. Man, I hope it's dead. Sandy looked in. At first, he was sure George was wrong. The thing was still alive, still breathing, or trying to breathe. Then he realized what he was seeing and told George to get the video cam out of the hutch. Oh, what about the... We won't need the rope, because we're not going in there. Not yet, we're not, but get the camera, fast as you can. George went around the side of the garage, not moving very well. Shock had made him gawky. Sandy looked back into the shed, cupping his eyes to the sides of his face to cut the red sunset glare. There was motion in the shed, all right, but not life's motion. It was mist rising from the thing's silver side and also from the purple slashes of its gills. The bat thing hadn't decomposed, but the leaves had, and quickly. This thing was starting to rot like the leaves, and Sandy had the feeling that once the process really got going, it would go fast. Even standing outside with the closed door between him and it, he could smell it. An acrid, watery reek of mixed cabbage and cucumber and salt, the smell of a broth you might feed to someone if you wanted to make them sicker instead of well. More mist was rising from its side. It dribbled up from the nest of tangled pink ropes that seemed to serve as its head as well. Sandy thought he could hear a faint hissing noise, but knew he could just as well be imagining it. Then a black slit appeared in the grayish silver scales, running north from the tattered nylon of its tail to the rearmost gill. Black fluid, probably the same stuff Huddy and Arky had found around the bat thing's corpse, began to trickle out, listlessly at first, then with a little more spirit.
Sandy could see an ominous bulge developing behind the split in the skin. It was no hallucination, and neither was the hissing sound. The fish was doing something more radical than decomposing. It was giving in, yielding to the change in pressure, or perhaps the change in everything, its whole environment. He thought of something he'd read once, or maybe seen in a National Geographic TV special, about how when some deep sea creatures were brought up from their dwelling places, they simply exploded. "George!" bawling at the top of his lungs. "Hurry the hell up!" George flew back around the corner of the shed, holding the tripod way up high where the aluminum legs came together. The lens of the video cam glared above his fist, looking like a drunk's eyeball in the day's declining red light. "I couldn't get it off the tripod," he panted. "There's some kind of latch or lock, and if I'd had time to figure it out, or maybe I was trying to turn the Chrysler thing backward. Never mind." Sandy snatched the video cam from him. There was no problem with the tripod, anyway. The legs had been adjusted to the height of the windows in the shed's two roll-up doors for years. The problem came when Sandy pushed the on button and looked through the viewfinder. Instead of a picture, there were just red letters reading, "Low Bat." "Judas, fucking Iscariot on a chariot-driven crutch. Go back, George. Look on the shelf by the box of blank tapes. There's another battery there. Get it." "But I want to see..." "I don't care. Go on." He went, running hard. His hat had gone askew on his head, giving him a weirdly jaunty look. Sandy pushed the record button on the side of the camera's housing, not knowing what he'd get, but hoping for something. When he looked into the viewfinder again, however, even the letters reading "Low Bat" were fading. "Kurt's gonna kill me," he thought. He looked back through the shed window just in time to catch the nightmare. The thing ruptured all the way up its side, spilling out that black ichor not in trickles, but in a flood. It spread across the floor like backflow from a clogged drain. Following it came a noisome spew of guts, flabby bags of yellowish-red jelly. Most of them split and began to steam as soon as the air hit them. Sandy turned, the back of his hand pressed hard against his mouth until he was sure he wasn't going to vomit, and then he yelled, "Herb, if you still want to look, now's your chance, quick as you can." Why getting Herb Avery on scene should have been the first thing he thought of, Sandy could not later say. At the time, however, it seemed perfectly reasonable. If he had called his dead mother's name, he would have been equally unsurprised. Sometimes one's mind simply passes beyond one's rational and logical control. Right then, he wanted Herb. Dispatch is never to be left unattended. It's a rule anyone in rural law enforcement knows, the fabled automatic. But rules were made to be broken, and Herb would never see anything like this again in his life. None of them would. And if Sandy couldn't have videotape, he would at least have a witness. Two, if George got back in time. Herb came out fast, as if he had been standing right inside the back door and watching through the screen all along, and sprinted across the nearly empty parking lot in the red light. His face was both scared and avid. Just as he arrived, George steamed back around the corner, waving a fresh battery for the video camera. He looked like a game show contestant who has just won the grand prize. "Oh, mother, what's that smell?" Herb asked, clapping his hand over his mouth and nose so that everything after "mother" came out muffled. "The smell isn't the worst," Sandy said. "You better get a look while you still can." They both looked and uttered almost identical cries of revulsion. The fish was blown out, all down its length by then, and deflating, sinking into the black liquor of its own strange blood. White billows rose from its body and the innards which had already spilled from that gaping flamant. The vapor was as thick as smoke rising from a pile of smoldering damp mulch. It obscured the Buick from its open trunk forward until Old 54 was nothing but a ghost car. If there had been more to see, Sandy might actually have fumbled longer with the camera, perhaps getting the battery in wrong ways on the first try, or even knocking the whole works over and breaking it in his fumble-fingered haste. The fact that there was going to be damn little to tape, no matter how fast he worked, had a calming effect, and he snapped the battery home on the first try. When he looked into the viewfinder again, he had a clear, bright view of not much. A disappearing amphibious thing that might have been a fabulous land-locked sea monster, or just a fishy version of the Cardiff Giant sitting on a concealed block of dry ice. On the tape, one can see the pink tangle that served as the amphibian's head quite clearly for perhaps 10 seconds, and a number of rapidly liquefying red lumps strewn along its length. One can see what appears to be filthy sea foam sweating out of the thing's tail and running across the concrete in a sluggish rill. Then the creature that convulsed its bulk out of the roadmaster's trunk is mostly gone. No more than a shadow in the mist. The car itself is hardly there. Even in the mist, however, the open trunk is visible, and it looks like a gaping mouth. Come closer, all good little children. Come closer. See the living crocodile. George stepped away, gagging and shaking his head. Sandy thought again of Curtis, who for a change had left as soon as his shift was over. He and Michelle had big plans. Dinner at the Cracked Platter in Harrison, followed by a movie. The meal would be over by now and they'd be at the show. Which one? There were three within striking distance. If there had been kids instead of just a maybe baby, Sandy could have called the house and asked the sitter. But would he have made that call? Maybe not. Probably not, in fact. Kurt had begun to settle a bit over the last 18 months or so, and Sandy hoped that settling would continue. He had heard Tony say on more than one occasion that when it came to the PSP, or any law enforcement agency worth its salt, one could best assess a man's worth by the truthful answer to a single question. How are things at home? It wasn't just that the job was dangerous. It was also a crazy job, full of opportunities to see people at their absolute worst. To do it well over a long period of time, to do it fairly, a cop needed an anchor. Kurt had Michelle, and now he had the baby. Maybe. It would be better if he didn't go bolting off to the barracks unless he absolutely had to, especially when he had to lie about the reason. A wife could swallow only so many rabid foxtails and unexpected changes in the duty roster. He'd be angry that he hadn't been called. Angrier still when he saw the bitched-up videotape. But Sandy would deal with that. He'd have to. And Tony would be back. Tony would help him deal with it. The following day was cool with a fresh breeze. They rolled up Shed B's big doors and let the place air out for 6 hours or so. Then four troopers, led by Sandy and a stony-faced Trooper Wilcox, went in with hoses. They cleaned off the concrete and washed the final decaying lumps of the fish out into the tall grass behind the shed. It was really the story of the bat all over again, only with more mess and less to show at the end of the day. In the end, it was more about Curtis Wilcox and Sandy Dearborn than it was about the ruins of that great unknown fish. Kurt was indeed furious at not having been called, and the two law enforcement officers had an extremely lively discussion on that subject, and others, when they had gotten to a place where no one else on the roster could possibly overhear. This turned out to be the parking lot behind the tap, where they had gone for a beer after the cleanup operation was finished. In the bar, it was just talking, but once outside, their voices started to climb. Pretty soon, they were both trying to talk at the same time, and of course, that led to shouting. It almost always does.
Man, I can't believe you didn't call me. You were off duty, you were out with your wife, and besides, there was nothing to see. I wish you'd let me decide. There wasn't. Decide that, Sandy. Any time. It all happened. Least you could have done was get some half-decent video for the file. Whose file are we talking about, Curtis, huh? Whose goddamn file?
By then, the two of them standing nose to nose, fists clenched, almost down to it. Yes, really on the verge of getting down to it. There are moments in a life that don't matter and moments that do, and some, maybe a dozen, when everything is on a hinge. Standing there in the parking lot, wanting to sock the kid who was no longer a kid, the rookie who was no longer a rookie, Sandy realized he had come to one of those moments. He liked Kurt, and Kurt liked him. They had worked together well over the last years, but if this went any further, all that would change. It depended on what he said next. It smelled like a basket of minks. That was what he said. It was a remark that came from nowhere at all, at least nowhere he could pinpoint. Even from the outside. How would you know what a basket of minks smelled like? Kurt starting to smile. Just a little. Call it poetic license. Sandy also starting to smile, but also only a little. They had turned in the right direction, but they weren't out of the woods. Then Curtis asked, did it smell worse than that whore's shoes? The one from Roxburgh? Sandy started laughing. Kurt joined him. And they were off the hinge, just like that. Come on in, Kurt said. I'll buy you another beer. Sandy didn't want another beer, but he said okay. Because now it wasn't about beer. It was about putting the crap behind them. Back inside, sitting in a corner booth, Kurt said, I've had my hands in that trunk, Sandy. I've knocked on the bottom of it. Me too. And I've been under it on a crawler. It's not a magician's trick like a box with a false bottom. Even if it was, that was no white rabbit that came out of there yesterday. Curtis said, for things to disappear, they only have to be in the vicinity. But when things show up, they always come out of the trunk. Do you agree? Sandy thought it over. None of them had actually seen the bat thing emerge from the Buick's trunk, but the trunk had been open all right. As for the leaves, yes. Phil Candleton had seen them swirling out. Do you agree? Impatient now, his voice saying Sandy had to agree. It was so goddamn obvious. It seems likely, but I don't think we have enough evidence to be 100% sure yet, Sandy replied at last. He knew saying that made him hopelessly stodgy in Curtis's eyes, but it was what he believed. One swallow doesn't make a summer. Ever heard that one? Kurt stuck out his lower lip and blew an exasperated breath up his face. Plain as the nose on your face. Ever heard that one? Kurt. Kurt raised his hands as if to say no, no, they didn't have to go back out into the parking lot and pick up where they had left off. I see your point. Okay? I don't agree, but I see it. Okay. Just tell me one thing. When'll we have enough to draw some conclusions? Not about everything, mind you, but maybe a few of the bigger things, like where the bat and the fish came from, for instance. If I had to settle for just one answer, it'd probably be that one. Probably never. Kurt raised his hands to the smoke-stained tin ceiling, then dropped them back to the table with a clump. Gah! I knew you'd say that. I could strangle you, Dearborn. They looked at each other across the table, across the tops of beers neither one of them wanted, and Kurt started to laugh. Sandy smiled, and then he was laughing, too.